Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Today is 11-12-13, November 12, 2013. We're here in the studio with our good buddies Ed Varastecki from Mug's Ale House and Bree O'Connor from Beer Sessions Radio. Hey, we're going to be talking with Steve Wood from Farnham Hill, also on the show tonight. So it's a big day in New York. There's the Union Beer Trade Tasting. We've got over 100 brewers from around the world in New York City and over 20 distillers. And after this show, we're all going to head over there and check it out. It's pretty exciting. I mean, there's so many great brewers from around the world that we've got to meet, you know, by having our Good Brew Seal bars, Ed. Are there any brewers that you're looking forward to meeting or getting reacquainted with today?
I think I'm ready to meet all of them. actually, you know, half of them I probably haven't met ever. You know, especially like I told you earlier, I'm one of the older people around here.
So who do you know? Which brewers? I mean, there's some brewers that come by Mug's Ale House, right?
Well, the guys from Smutty, you know, of course, because at one point Mug's was actually a big, huge Smutty IPA account, and probably I think it was second to their brew pub at one point, you know, so we were really doing good numbers with them. So, of course, we had them show up, and I believe the guys from Firestone Walker were there. You know, we've had a lot of them show up through the years, you know, depending, again, like I said, Mr. Geary was there last night. He hangs out in Mug's.
So David Geary came by Mug's?
Oh, he always hangs out. But he doesn't drink beer. He drinks gin and tonics.
You're not supposed to tell me that.
Why not?
And Bree's on the show. Bree, since day one's been our co-founding producer of Beer Sessions Radio. And
she's a bad girl.
She's officially moving on, taking care of some family things, and it's been a great almost 4 years, Bree. Thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, Jimmy.
And we've got our new co-producers that she's groomed. We've got Justin Kennedy and Maggie Seiden, who are working with us. But it's so nice to sit with you. I don't know if you've ever officially been on the show, even though you've been behind all the shows.
No, I usually sit in the booth and make smart-ass comments. So
make faces.
This is a nice change of pace.
Well, there were so many good friends that you got to meet. I know you were really close with Ray Dieter.
Yes.
And Dave Broderick. And who are some of the favorite guests that you got to know from the show?
Oh, boy. There's an almost endless list. There's just been a lot of really amazing, fun people. And one of the great things that I've learned from being involved with the show is how much more I love the product after I meet the person, because after I meet the person, the product makes sense. Like, I know exactly why that guy made that beer, and that's kind of what makes it such a personal and exciting industry.
That's a great way of looking at it. I was like, I never thought of it that way, but I agree. I agree with you 1,000% with that one. Wow.
And you've met so many great people too. Well, when we first started, I mean, what were some of the challenges of booking a show when no one really knew us?
Well, being a completely unknown entity is the first thing, is trying to explain to people what we are, that we're available on the internet, and you can get us, that we're archived. Just, it was a very new thing, and a lot of people didn't know who we were, and I was reaching out across the country, but but once we got a fair group of people who are local and who started to support us and started to bring in other people, it's pretty much snowballed. And right now, I think we're on a pretty good clip, which is a lot of fun. Right now, I brought in a couple of things. I was kind of feeling nostalgic. So I brought in a few things from some of, I call them guests I keep in my fridge. I brought a Rayon Vert from Green Flash.
You should have brought the whole fridge.
I should have brought the whole fridge. I thought about it, but I'm sure my fridge does not rival Yaroslav.
Oh, stop.
It really doesn't. Not by a long shot. I also brought along, I really had a lot of fun having a back and forth with Mazen Hajar from 961 Beer, the Lebanese brewer. So I brought his pale ale, which I've been sipping on quite frequently.
Is that the one with the local spices?
Yeah. It's a very... pale ales aren't my favorite in general. Like, I find them kind of passable but not exciting. But this one I find really exciting.
Yeah. And the Réinvert, too. That's really great. I know last year, Ed's done, 7 years of his Belgian event?
Yeah, this is going to be our eighth, first weekend in December, December 7th and 8th.
And at Jimmy's number 43, we're on our fourth or fifth annual Battle of the Belgians, which is this coming Saturday, November 16th. The first year I did it, Ed and I booked the same date as Ed.
Stepped on each other's toes.
He gave me a friendly email.
But, it was friendly. I didn't curse you out or anything. Come on.
So now we don't book them on. But ours is a little different. Like your event, that's why the Réinvert reminds me of that. Because, I mean.
Right. You do it different.
For some customers, this is like their favorite kind of new world. You know, it's like it's a little hoppy. It's Belgian-y. It's a little sour. Not really sour finish, though, right? It's like a wild yeast
beer. I never thought of it as a sour. I mean, there's a little tartiness to it. But I don't think it's totally a wild ale, as they call it. So it's good. I mean, Green Flash, I love. You know, great brewery.
So what beers are you going to have at your Belgian festival?
God, I was just going through them today, and, you know, off the top of my head, I've just, you know, we're trying to do, I'm getting a whole bunch of stuff from 12%, and, you know, we're doing a lot of things. We've actually worked with them lately pretty decently, and we're getting a lot of things from them. But, you know, just off the top of my head, I mean, we're going to have some beers from Flying Dog that are going to be there tonight. You know, they're going to be there. God, now you put me on the spot. I should have bought the list, actually.
Well, that's Brie.
What beers am I going to put up? Yeah. Tell me.
Well, how about this? Which brewers are you looking forward to meeting tonight at the Union Beer Tasting?
It's kind of like everybody's going to be there. I don't know if we should disclose that yesterday you had your little secret taping.
Disclose it. He didn't invite me, so disclose it.
I am really excited to stop by and check out Irene and Jamie from Full Sail and meet Dick Cantwell, partially because they had a great back and forth. And I know that when I have a great back and forth with somebody, that it's going to be fun.
I think it's going to be a fun event for everybody. I mean, I'm looking forward to it, and especially going with you guys and Jimmy's limo. It's going to be fun to get there. And
living the high life.
And, yeah, no, I think it's going to be a great event. And I'm actually, I mean, I went to one, I remember that they did years ago at the Puck Building, which was, I thought, phenomenal. And now they're supposedly, you know, because it is a trade show, we can actually drink and order at the same time, which could be a dangerous thing.
Well, you mean so we can actually go there and place wholesale orders for
Yeah,
for
supposedly
beer.
We can order right there. They're going to have some sort of software.
So I could order hundreds of cases of beer.
Right, and you're going to wake up tomorrow.
Not have to pay for it.
When they show up at the doorstep and you look at the bill and say, uh-oh.
Well, it's pretty smart.
In my case, my wife is going to say, no way in hell.
Let me tell you, I'm looking forward to seeing a good friend of ours, Mr. Toshi Kaiuchi. I don't think we've ever had him on the show.
No, he's been by your place a few times.
Yeah, and a couple years ago when there was the big Japanese earthquake and tsunami, we helped organize a fundraiser at Brooklyn Brewery. But since then, he's become a friend. And he has a new beer out called the Dai Dai, which he brought to us last year in New York. And now it's available in New York. So we're getting a case of the Hattuccino Dai Dai, which is made with it's like an orange rind in there, real subtle flavoring. We're going to have that at Jimmy's number 43.
That's what
tomorrow.
You get for being in the city.
But the Dai Dai.
We're in Brooklyn.
Hey, let's talk about this.
We don't count.
Favorite beers of the year, man. We're getting near the end of the year.
Oh,
I'm going to say mine's going to be the Hattuccino Dai Dai because even though I had it last year, I know it's going to really be a game changer. What about you, Ed? Favorite beer of the year?
Oh, God. They're tough. I mean, you know, there's been so many good beers that have come through mugs. And, you know, one, I'm just going to stick with a couple that were, you know, at least one of them that we have up right now, which is the Smutty Rye IPA. I think it's the first year they brewed it. I'm not certain. But their rye IPA has really been good with me. I mean, I love it. I mean, I'm a hophead, and it's been there, and it's good. You know, we're pouring it. But then a lot of Barrier stuff. I mean, I love Barrier. You know, he's been doing a great job over there. And
Pick one, Barry.
Oh, Bumble.
Okay.
Bumble. Actually, Bumble, after we did the green space thing, is the first time I tried it at Dave's at Blind Tiger, and I fell in love with it there, and ever since I've been trying to get as much as possible at Mugs, and we've been pouring the hell out of it.
Oh, so. I haven't had that yet.
Oh, it's a great IPA. I fell in love with it.
It's like a wheat IPA.
Yeah, it's a wheat IPA. Oh, really? It kind of reminds me of the Gumball Head from Three Floyds. Like, it has a couple of characteristics of the same, if you ever had Three Floyds.
Yeah,
the Gumball Head. And you know, years ago, the Gumball Head I never really liked, and now it's like, whew. And I AB'd both of them, and I'm like, wow, this is great.
And Bri, what's one of your favorite beers of the year?
Of the year? See, then now you're getting into... Jimmy,
I know,
A,
it's tough to say.
I don't get out much, first of all. Second of all, it all kind of, I get so much that honestly, to pull out like what was new this year is difficult for my mommy brain to handle.
All right, we got mommy brain and daddy brain over
there. Yeah, daddy brain. Well, no, daddy half a brain.
Well, how about this? Let's go even farther back. So, right. One great thing with the show, you introduced me to so many interesting beers from around the country that we really couldn't get in New York, like, for example, Surly.
Yeah. Oh, Surly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that one, I that was a big cheat being a Minnesotan myself. It was very exciting to see Surly come up. And definitely really exciting to bring them to the show.
You didn't have them in your refrigerator? You could have accompanied the other friends?
That's the thing. I don't get back to Minnesota very often, and they have a smaller distribution world. It doesn't quite reach here yet. But and that's because they really care about their consumers and are keeping their distribution
circle
tight.
And they have some cool beers in cans too, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, personally, I really like Surly Hell. I think it's quite good. I've not had Darkness yet, which a certain previous guest that I know quite well made a rather interesting comment that made me want to try Darkness. I'm not sure if you want me to get that blue. It was Corey Bonfilio, who...
Proletarian.
Yes. Who, you know, can get colorful when he speaks. And he told me that Darkness was so good, it would make your dick fall off. And I thought... I'm sorry for you.
That good?
wow, that's good.
I think I'm safe trying it, but yep. haven't had it yet. So never there on Darkness.
I'm never going to try it.
Well, then let's keep going back. I'm thinking about all the great shows you booked. Okay, so one time there was that like long-standing Seattle beer bar that we did a phone call with.
Goodness.
And they owned a couple other beer bars.
Yes. Why can't it?
Does it begin with an L?
The name escapes me. Oh, Brett's going to kill me.
I bet they're Googling it right now.
goodness, that was...
And we talked to the woman in Idaho with Idaho? The tiny brew pub. Was it Pink Pony? Pink something.
Pink.
God, I missed
Pink
the word.
Penny Pink is her name.
Penny Pink.
Penny Pink is the brewer's name.
And sorry, and, Penny, you know, if you're out there.
Yeah, and she has
that was
a
great
She was a nuclear physicist who opened a brew pub, who just discovered brewing and then decided, yeah, this physics thing is not for me, and went in to open her own brew pub with a very, very sort of rock and roll kind of flair in Idaho. And she is really like, what a pioneer.
I regret I missed a lot of good shows.
Yeah.
I think Maggie and Justin are like furiously researching all these far-flung, and you know, because Justin was just in Asheville, North Carolina, so there's all these we're in New York City, and I know a lot of people listen to the show because they want to know where to go in New York, but for us, it's exciting when we get to talk to people from other states, and
right.
A lot, especially the beers that we don't get in New York.
Well, to harken back to Ed, Dave Geary, he was a great guest, and an entertaining man, to say the least.
You know, I wish I would have been on the show when he was here, because I, you know, he's always he comes to Mugs every time he's in New York, and we love him.
Yeah,
and you know, he shows up, and he's a great guy, and I can't wait to see him tonight. Actually, so
yeah, and he does not mince words. He's very clear on what.
And I'll tell you guys, like, right, you know, I'm going to jump in. If you're listening live, many listen to it on iTunes, but if you're listening live, there's still a chance to go to this great Union Beer tasting event. Tomorrow night, Wednesday, November 13th, it is open to the public, and I think there's a discount code out there. If you send us @beer_sessions, you can get a discount ticket to the craft exp.com, and
it's gonna be a fun big event.
Yeah, big event. I mean, want to meet all these brewers. There's many that I've, you know, it's like Full Sails, Elysian, people coming from the West Coast, people from Japan, Italy, Germany. You know, it's gonna be wild.
Yeah.
Hey, we're gonna take a short break. We have a big part of the show today. We've got Steve Wood from Farnham Hill Cider in New Hampshire. He's gonna be on the phone with us. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Hey.
This one's called Leaving by Dead Stars on the Heritage Radio Network, going out to Bree O'Connor. Beer Sessions Radio.
Do you want to taste the finest beer and spirits from over 125 breweries and 30 distilleries? The Craft Experience, the most exclusive craft and spirit tasting event in New York, hosted by great brewers, is available to the public for the first time ever. Join your fellow beer and spirit enthusiasts on Wednesday, November 13th in Manhattan to mingle with the superstars of the craft beverage world. Tickets are available now at www.thecraftexp.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio. Bree O'Connor here, you know, our co-founding, long-time producer, buddy, friend, partner, everything.
And we
love
have
you, baby. You're awesome.
Oh, cheers. And
we have a woman back in the studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are girls in...
Well, no, last show, they were blown away by me because I sat here. We had like five guys in here, and the last couple shows I showed up at, there was
okay,
always women.
Ed, you're on the... We're talking about your Belgian beer event.
Yeah.
Tell me three beers you're going to have at your Belgian beer fest.
God, why are you putting
you don't have
on the
three
spot?
Beers on your mind.
Lambic X, we're going to do that. We have no, I don't have them on my mind cuz right. I just went
Are you doing a coast to coast toast with Van Bergen DeWolf this week?
Yeah, I was going to.
Do you have any beers coming in from them?
I think so, and I don't know what's showing up from you.
I'll tell you what I'm doing on Thursday at Jimmy's number 43.
God,
Thursday tap, we have
brain.
The Scaldi's
say,
triple. We got Monk Stout on draft. We got from DuPont the one of them.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
See, there you go.
Thank God I'm rubbing off on you. I really like that. It makes me feel a hell of a lot better.
All right, now we're getting the serious part of the show.
Let's talk about beer.
Okay,
now.
There's a guy on the phone. We're going to switch over to cider. Cider Week has been such an important part of our New York experience. It's been growing. This was the third year, and Steve Wood came down. We had a bunch of great tastings and a dinner with him. Really showcasing the best of the northeastern, orchardists, apple growers, cider makers. And Steve's on. Steve, how are you, buddy?
Good, pal. How are you?
Thanks for making the call. I know we had a little back and forth, and I'm going to start with a couple questions, and then I'll let you take over. Just give us a little background. So for our listeners, tell us, how you first got involved in apples, and a little backstory on what you're doing up in New Hampshire.
Shoot, man. Well, I've been growing apples here at the same orchard since 1965. Or rather, I started working here when I was a kid in 1965. And I did various things, but I took over production at this orchard, which was we were grower, packer, shippers, mainly of Maxi Portlands and some very good ground in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Took over the production in 1973, I think, and bought the dump in 1984.
So what were you doing? You're just a kid? You started hanging out at an apple orchard?
What's that?
How did you start working at an apple orchard?
I just started working in an apple orchard. It had a bit to do with my father. It was just one of those things. I was 11 years old, pal. I don't know what.
Right.
I was working in an apple orchard.
Yeah, Jimmy. Come on. What's the matter with you?
But, yeah, and so, and then things kind of changed, and now we grow cider apples.
And then what changed for you guys? I mean, you were serious about selling apples, right? That was your thing.
Yeah, we were packing and shipping, exporting to England, selling up and down the Eastern Seaboard. You know, and we used to get a real premium for very high quality McIntosh and Cortlands, which are pretty damned hard to find anymore. In a way, they're not really. There are some good ones out there, but they're hard to distinguish in the market anymore. And what we were able to do back in the day, we can still do it now, is grow kind of mid-sized, really hard, delicious apples. Delicious, not, I don't mean the variety. I mean they tasted good. But various things happened in the 80s that kind of changed the economics of running an orchard like that. And they had to do with the mechanization of packing. And also with, you know, I mean, God, all you guys, I mean, the whole bloody America started insisting on great, huge, uniform-sized apples in the supermarkets and started insisting on them being wax. And, you know, in that context, we couldn't distinguish ourselves anymore. And in these bony northeastern hillside orchards, we can't compete on production efficiency for, you know, parts of the country where, apple-growing country where rows disappear over the curvature of the earth. You know, we've got these very irregular fields all over the place, orchards all over the place. We never were brilliant on production efficiency, but we can grow the hell out of an apple. But that the premium we used to get for having really good fruit just started to disappear, and we realized that we had to change. This was in the 80s, basically.
And then when did you start making hard cider?
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, I guess everybody who grew apples made hard cider for the whole time. But I started some grafting trials of a couple hundred varieties, American and English and French cider varieties, in the early 80s. And the truth is that I was just fooling around. I mean, we had a business. I didn't know this was going to be our business. I just thought we had a little retail stand, as we still do. I thought, you know, cider might be a cool little retail sideline. I, for one reason or another, had spent a fair bit of time in England and a little bit of time in France, and I knew a lot of cider growers and cider makers in England, or had gotten to know them during the course of the 80s. But, the truth is I was almost gardening. We had a business. I wasn't planning on cutting down all the trees and planting all these inedible apples, but it turned out, when we decided we couldn't keep going, doing what we were doing, we took a deep breath and realized that we had a decade of horticultural experience with all these strange, many of them inedible apples for hard cider, and that among all the hundreds of varieties we tested, we'd found a handful that we could grow the hell out of here, that we could grow to the same high standard that we used to get a premium for with McIntosh and Cortland. So we took a deep breath, and God, this was loony, but we got the bulldozers and grafting knives out. We got rid of acres and acres of very productive, good McIntosh and Cortland orchards and turned them over into inedible cider varieties. And that was late 80s, early 90s, and sort of through the 90s. I guess we got bonded. We became a bonded winery, I think, in 95. I think that's right. Anyway, so whatever. That's what we did.
So you got a little story. So, like, when you first started making cider, you know, what was your inspiration? I mean, you know,
I don't know. Shoot, I mean, it was a traditional drink in New England, but the real inspiration was I'd really, by just good luck, I'd gotten to know a lot of really good cider makers in the UK. I knew the west of England by the end of the year. I knew that part of the country pretty well, Hereford and Somerset. I knew good apple growers there, and I knew a lot of cider makers. I knew the researchers there, and I liked cider, you know. And we thought, but it became clear to me before we even planted a single cider apple tree that to make what I think is really good cider, you got to grow the right apples. And a lot of those apples just aren't the same as eating apples. They just aren't. And so I guess that was the inspiration. I guess in a way the real inspiration was we had to do something or get out of business. So I don't know.
I think we can all relate to that. So
I should probably say the same thing now. I probably ought to get out of business. I don't know what. But anyway, it's still, you know, we're still doing it.
Well, it's a couple of, like, just little questions. Okay. So you you've said that you like to make still rather than sparkling ciders, or you used to. What's the difference in your approach to that?
Well, it's not used to. I don't know, man. I think the real deal with cider, if you got really good fruit, is dead dry, unfiltered, completely still, no bubbles cider from good fruit. You know, treated well, probably matured for 8 to 12 months, and just put in a bottle. But unfortunately, at least at this stage of the market, that's still a pretty hard sell because people aren't accustomed to that. And I don't dislike bubbles. Tell Jimmy, you know we don't make sweet stuff. Somebody else can make the sweet stuff. So all of our sweetest ciders are pretty darn dry. But, we partly make cider not really for the public taste, but we know that we've got to bring people to real cider. And so we've got to make some moderate crowd pleasers. And there are limits. We're not going to, like I say, we're not going to make some wicked sweet thing, but we'll, we're making some nice bubbly things and some slightly off dry things. But, in a perfect world, we'd grow great fruit. We'd make just straight up cider, which would be still and what it is. I mean, one fine day, maybe that's going to be possible. We're sure selling a lot more still dry cider than we ever did before. In fact, we're about to send some in kegs to New York.
Steve, take a step back. Steve, because Ed from Mugs Alice, he asked me that. He asked me if he could get kegs.
Right. I was just curious if there was any kind of keg format of cider coming in.
Oh, yeah, sure there is. I mean, there's all kinds of keg cider coming in. Frankly, ours is pretty expensive. I mean, because we...
Everything is expensive.
A lot of the cider out there, a lot of the industrial cider takes about 10 weeks to make. Ours takes about a year to make.
Mm.
So you start with a real estate problem. Anyway, but yeah, we sent a bunch of, it's mostly, 6 to 5 gallon kegs to New York. Not a huge number, but we're scattered around the city.
Okay, when are they showing up so I can get one?
They still come down.
Talk to Jimmy. I'm not going to start naming business.
Okay, all right. We're going over to the trade show later on today. We'll talk to them.
I bet they're going to be there. Okay. So, Ed, also, Steve, so some other things like tannins and apples. I only learned this year for Cider Week that apples have tannins. I never thought about that. I knew that's the case with wine. How do you think about developing flavors in your ciders, based on the apples and all that stuff? I'm just trying to get you to talk.
I don't know. I mean, how do you make Chardonnay du Pape? I don't know. You start with some good grapes. You're in the southern run. I mean, hell, I don't know. I'll tell you what we think is that, and mind you, this is really subjective. There are a lot of different good ciders out there, but the kind of cider we really admire and we are trying to make has some tannic structure. It's got kind of an underpinning of bitterness and astringency and kind of just a form underneath it. It's got all kinds of nice fruity elements to it, and it needs a nice bright acidity so nothing sits on your tongue for 6 weeks making you wish you had a glass of water when you get done drinking it. So it needs to smell good, it needs to have some structure and feel good and taste good in your mouth, and then it needs to go away in a happy way instead of in a way that leaves you asking for a glass of milk. And in order to do that, you need some very tannic apples, and the best of those that I've ever found are actually low in acid, but really bitter, astringent, just nasty damned apples in your hand. I mean, the good joke of what we're doing now is we went from growing really high quality eating apples to growing, I guess, very high. I mean, they are very high quality, but apples that, shoot, if you put one of these apples in a kid's lunchbox, you're going to family court, man. these things are bad to eat. They just are, they make bloody good cider. So, but that again, I'm not, that's our view here. There are a lot of different ways to make cider. The main thing I think is, you got to start with the right fruit. And just in the same way that you can make wine out of table grapes out of the supermarket, and there's a bucket load of Thompson seedless grapes grown in the world, but for selling at the supermarket, but you don't see a Thompson seedless grape aisle in the wine shops. Well, the same thing's true of a lot of eating apples. You know, you can make cider out of them, but you're kind of limited in what you can get out of it. So cider apples are like wine grapes in that regard. They aren't necessarily good eating apples in the way that, you know, just whatever, Cabernet Sauvignon isn't a very good eating grape. Their whole excuse for existence is what they bring to the fermented liquid.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, so Bri O'Connor's our producer, and it's her last day today, and she's booked a number of cider shows. I just want to ask her, Bri, one of our first cider shows, we brought in some home cider makers. Do you want to reflect on that and share that with Steve?
Oh, you mean Joy and Jeremy?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Park Slope, I was here for
exactly.
That.
And
Steve's met them too.
That's right. They, they go and get they source their apples, obviously, because they can't have an orchard here in Brooklyn. But they're really, really interesting, very passionate cider makers. I'm curious what you might encourage home cider makers to do. From the get-go, what is the first thing they need to know?
Well, this is a tough one. We've given a lot of home cider-making classes. And, I mean, I guess that you first have got to get the best fruit you can. But, you know, the unhappy fact is, at least right now, it's really hard to get really good cider fruit. You know, and just going and buying heirloom, people think, you know, just because something's old, it makes good cider. Well, you know, people used to eat green meat, you know, just some of the old varieties aren't very good for much of anything. We grow a lot of heirloom varieties, but they aren't all good. No, the ones we grow, I think, are good. But the thing is, just going and buying an heirloom variety, the juice made from one of those things, doesn't matter, doesn't really mean anything. I mean, I guess the thing is to say that try to find some juice that's got nice bright acidity, and you know, if you can get a hold of some tannic juice, do it. And my main encouragement to people is that growers all over the country are finally planting more and more of this stuff, so more of this juice is going to become available. And that the only other thing, the really strong advice, and the trouble is that this is most home cider is still made by home brewers. Brewing is like cooking. Cider making is like wine making. And the trouble with brewers making cider, in the same way the trouble with brewers making wine, is they want to fiddle with it all the time. And so I guess while you're looking for good fruit, the first few years while you're learning how to do it, keep your bloody hands off it once you get it fermenting. And stop, you know, don't keep adjusting and fiddling and whatever. Just leave it alone. Let it make itself. Once it gets going, if you got good fruit, it makes itself. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it's awesome. Hey, Steve, will you stay on the line with us? You stick around? We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes here on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
This one's called Kill Me in the Summertime by Dead Stars on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage. What did I say? Hey. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio.
That's a Jimmy Walker from...
I'll give the shout-out. We're here out in Bushwick, Brooklyn, at Roberta's.
Fat Albert, sorry. Right. Here's my trivia.
So, Steve, you still on the line with us?
Yeah.
Steve Wood from Farm Hill Cider in New Hampshire. So, Ed Barastecki from Mugs Ale House, who's going to become one of your good customers... He had a couple questions. First, Ed, what? You have some apple trees in your home? And,
yeah, I mean, you know, I was
you
curious.
You live in Brooklyn or Queens?
Well, no, I have a place upstate, so we have a couple of...
Where?
We inherited up in Jeffersonville, New York, and we inherited a couple of apple trees, and these they bloom, and we get fruit, and the apples, they look like they're Macintosh. A couple of the trees look like they're Macintosh apple trees, but they're all spotted in black. And I know that my wife, she said that we have to, you know, prune them and all this other stuff, which we have to do. But the fruit that's been coming out, actually, we've peeled it, and it's pretty tasty. But I'm curious, what does the black, like, spotting mean? Is it, like, too much water, not enough water, or something else?
Dude.
Or it's something that you can't answer.
It's probably apple scab, which is Venturia inequalis, which is a fungus that is the commonest fungus that infects apple trees in the Northeast and actually in the world. But man, you know, I mean, we aren't the only creatures on this earth that like apples. You have fungi, bacteria, insects, arachnids, oh, there are all kinds of things that will, you know, I mean, I say attack, but they aren't really attacking apples. They're just trying to do what we do. You know, they're using them to eat. They're using them to lay eggs in. I guess we don't lay eggs in them, but anyway, right. You know, so it's probably scab. And I guess my advice, I mean, you know, we have to, I run a commercial orchard. We need to keep the trees healthy and keep the fruit relatively clean, so we do need to spray a bit. My advice to everybody who's got a couple of apple trees in your backyard is either really make a complete study of all the diseases and insects and everything, or don't spray. Don't go down to the garden center and buy yourself.
No, we haven't sprayed. I hope that we ate them is not a bad thing.
I got to tell you one other thing, which is you said you need to prune them.
Right.
You need to prune them if you want them to do something for you. Apple trees are trees, just like the trees in the forest.
Right.
And the worst day in their life was when the happy homeowner comes out fingering the blade of a pruning saw.
Oh, really?
You know, thinking that the poor tree needs pruning. The poor tree doesn't need anything.
Don't prune them.
I'm just saying, again, if we prune everything, but... You know, we know how to do it, and we're trying to make the trees do something. It's like training a dog. We're trying to make the trees do our bidding. But if you don't know what you're doing, you're probably doing more harm than good with a pruning saw. And I'm not saying that you can't do it. I'm just saying if you're going to prune the trees and try to get, you know, get the advantages of pruning, you can't just go out and start cutting on a tree. I mean, you can, fortunately, because apple trees are like Labradors. They're one of the most forgiving creatures on the earth. You can kick the hell out of them.
I'm just going to drive up to you, and I'm going to bring you back, and you're going to help me. That's all. we'll figure it out that way.
How many people have to come help them with their apple trees in their backyard? I mean, you know, I've got a day job like you. You know,
yeah, that's right. We all need a vacation.
Steve, on that note, are there other cider makers around the country that you're going to and helping with either some of your cuttings or giving them advice that we should know about so we can
I mean, there are a lot of them. I mean, the great pleasure at the moment is a lot of commercial growers, really good apple growers, not necessarily all cider makers, are starting to plant some of these varieties. And we've been giving away budwood propagation material of all these varieties for years, and I don't know, 3 years ago I may have given away 3,000 buds. This year I think I gave away 50,000 buds. Maybe that's kind of crazy because we're sort of killing a market that we sell this fruit all over the country and the juice all over the country to people who don't have the sort of juice we grow. But what we're trying to do is encourage people all over the country to grow their own damn juice. And I guess our theory is that, you know, real cider regions will start to develop when people start growing apples in their own apple-growing regions for the purpose of making cider, not just using, you know, cold dessert fruit, but actually growing cider fruit. And that really is starting to happen, and I guess we have helped people a lot do that. And, you know, unlike a lot of folks, we don't play our cards very close to the breast. No, we don't play them at all close to the breast. We'll tell anybody anything about what we do. And so we have, I guess, advised a lot of people about, you know, how to get going in making cider. One of the things, the main piece of advice that we give people that they don't really quite take a lot of the time is don't think you know what you're doing. I mean, we know we don't know what we're doing. We've been doing it as long and probably longer than pretty much anybody in the country. We feel like rank amateurs here. And I think our cider, if it's any damn good, it's partly good, largely good, because we know we don't know what we're doing. We're always trying to figure out how to do it. So, and you know, we have tried to get other people making the stuff and growing the right fruit and all that, you know, and it's finally really happening, which is very encouraging.
Steve, to jump ahead a little bit, I mean, a little more political, we joked about, I said that can cider change the world, but then you said, could cider be a game changer for Northeast small farmers?
Well, you remember my answer to the first question is pretty much no. So I don't know that cider can actually change the world, except to the extent that it's one more pleasure in the world. But it can. I mean, in the same way that it's kept my orchard alive. We're not a 2-acre orchard. We've got about 100 acres here of fruit. And it, we actually that varies, goes up and down. But you know, most of the time there are 80 acres or so with trees in it, and that land is starting to make sense, economic sense again. In the same way that it did, you know, 30 years ago when we were growing really good Macintosh and getting paid for it. And I do think that if a cider market for really good cider that depends on the right kind of fruit develops in this country, and I think it is going to develop, it is developing right now, there are a lot of orchards, not just in the Northeast, but all over the country, that'll start making better sense economically than they do right now. And that does save land from the bulldozer. So that's kind of cool. I don't know.
That's great. And one last question. Talk about the Johnny Appleseed myth. Because you're kind of like Johnny Appleseed now.
You talk about the Johnny Appleseed myth. The guy was a whack job, all right? He was a Swedenborgian who, I don't know enough about him to really be able to talk. I mean, I do know that he was planting seedlings for cider. And so the notion that he was going around planting apple trees for apple pie and mom is completely wrong. I know he was smart about, you know, I mean, he had a pretty good business going on because he was basically a nurseryman and a salesman. But, I don't know. I think most, hell, man. You know, I mean, you know, tell me about Pope Innocent III. Give me a break. I don't know.
Exactly, Jimmy. Give the guy a break.
I'm only asking questions based on your reaction. So, but you're kind of like a Johnny Appleseed then, though. But you're out there propagating.
What's that?
You're almost like a Johnny Appleseed now.
Well, I'm not a Swedenborgian. I might be a whack job. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what, you know. Yeah, we're grafting and planting trees and trying to talk other people into doing it. So I guess to that extent we're doing that. But look, you know, the other thing, the other question you asked, which is your note to me, this isn't just me. This is, I mean, this place, Farnham Hill Ciders, I guess we're doing a pretty good job. But without, you know, the people who work, I mean, Brenda and Fitz and Nicole and my wife Louisa and I, we'd be dead in the water. We could not do this without the really, you know, very good people who've gravitated here and continue to work here. And it's a little business, but it's a highly collaborative business. I mean, I run the show, I make the decisions, but we got good people here. And that's had a lot to do with the development of, among other things, our styles of cider and the, you know, the horticulture in our orchards as well. So but yeah, I guess, yeah, Johnny Appleseed, geez, I don't know whether to be insulted or not, but I'm not a Swedenborgian, okay?
Don't be insulted.
No, it's all good. No, it's all good. Just kidding.
Swedenborgian. And
you know, well, anyway, look, that's another thing. It's probably not for Beer Sessions Radio. Go look it up in Wikipedia.
And then the last thing, of course, we're drinking your ciders right now. My favorite's always been the Kingston Black, but when you came up for Cider Week, you tasted us on some of your new Perry, which is the pear-based cider. Are you going to make the Perry, or are you still in experimental phase?
Oh, man. You know, when we started doing this stuff, I grafted a bunch of Perry pears, too. And Perry pears, good Perry pears, you have one thing in common with good cider apples, which is you can't eat them. They taste awful. This commercial experiment, we started all these grafting trials back in the 80s and 90s. Just shifting to these strange apple varieties was just about all we could bear to do, if you know what I mean. And damn it, a few years ago, the few grafted pear trees you've got started to bear pretty good fruit. And we finally started to make a few barrels of Perry, and I don't think our Perry's all that good yet. But we were really intrigued by it, so now we're planting Perry pears, And, you know, Perry pears take about 12 years to come into bearing. I'm in my 60th year. You know, I'm going to be walking with two sticks and spitting out my teeth before we really know how to make Perry, but we're going to try to
do
it.
So is Jimmy.
I don't know what
that's
you folks
for next week, isn't
we'll
it?
Make some good Perry by and by.
Yeah, no, and that's great, man. Hey, Steve, it was great getting to see you again in Cider Week this year in New York, and look forward to seeing you again. And do you guys give tours if people are up in New England? Can they stop by the Poverty Lane Orchard, or do you shoot?
Yeah,
people?
I mean, the answer to the first question is no, we don't give tours. But you know, in the fall we're open for you. We got a regular pick your own orchard and all the other stuff. And if people wander in here, you know, fortunately there aren't that many people who wander in, and we're very happy to let them wander. I mean, we're happy to let them wander around anyway. So anybody who comes up here is happy to look all over the place and take walks in the orchard and come poke around the cider room. We usually, if we got time, somebody will show them what we're doing. But this, you know, I mean, this is I'm sitting on a cold concrete floor and it's about 19 degrees outside. This is not a tasting room with teak-lined walls and a Pepsi and silk, you know, address with pouring into tasting glasses. You know, it's a production place. And we're very happy to have people come visit, but quite often it's not quite what they expect.
So yeah, we're driving up there.
It's a nice place, you know. People, you know, I mean, we got beautiful orchards, and people walk around them, and you know, there's cider in the tanks, whatever.
Well, you know what? Thanks for coming on, Steve. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. All right.
So, yeah, thank you, folks. See you later, Jimmy.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks,
Steve. And, Steve, thank you.
Couple of events coming up. Ed, tell us about when's your Belgian Fest again?
Belgian Fest is December 7th and 8th. We're going to be doing 20, hopefully around 20 each day, as we always do. And
20 beers on draft.
Yes. Yeah. So that's it.
And then we're doing at Jimmy's number 43 this weekend, the 5th annual Battle of the Belgians. We'll have over 30 different Belgian and Belgian-style beers, including the Green Flash Rayon Vert, which is one of our favorites. And that was great. And Brie O'Connor, thanks so much for everything you've done for Beer Sessions Radio.
Oh,
I know you're going to do some new things and take care of your family. Yeah. And looking forward to seeing that great book about beer or something else soon from you.
I'll let you know.
All right. Cool. And I'd also like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Beer Sessions Radio is also supported by the Good Beer Seal, of which Mugs, Ale House, and Jimmy's Number 43 are members. You can find us on Facebook, and also you can follow us, check us out on Twitter at @beer_sessions. If you like this podcast, give us a good review on iTunes. Thanks to Ed, Steve, and Bree for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Kinsley, Brie O'Connor, engineer Joe Galarraga, and our new producers, Justin Kennedy and Megan Seiden. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. Cheers to Brie O'Connor.
Woo!
All right.
Hey,
it's
hey,
Brie
hey.
O'Connor Day in New York City.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.